Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Today on the show, a changing of the guard at Twitter, and the sky is falling in Greece. I know, but this time, it might really be falling. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl, who's out on assignment. It is Thursday, June 11th. Glad to have you here. Leading the news today, Twitter CEO Dick Costolo is stepping down. Investors have been calling for a shakeup at the top as Twitter struggles to grow, to get new users, and more importantly, to keep those new users. Twitter's going back to a familiar face for interim leadership, Jack Dorsey, who helped found Twitter and was previously its CEO. He now runs another huge tech company, the mobile payment service Square. And just last month, Dorsey sat down with Mr. Kai Rizdahl and said things were going just fine at Twitter.
Can't get the executive chairman of Twitter in front of a microphone and say, and not ask him whether you've got confidence in the leadership of that company, Costolo in particular.
Well, that's an easy question. I have extreme confidence in the leadership team of the company.
You can hear Kai's complete interview with Jack Dorsey on our website, marketplace.org. Meanwhile, I asked Marketplace tech's Ben Johnson what happened.
So Twitter has had this continuing problem. We've heard over and over in every quarterly earnings call that the company hasn't really gotten the growth in user numbers and the growth in revenue that it really wants. Every quarter we've heard over and over that, yeah, that'll get better next quarter, but it just hasn't happened. And that's really the difference between Twitter and a Facebook, for instance. Dick Costolo has been really engaged in this process. He's really tried a lot of innovative things by some measures, but the company just hasn't been able to get the user growth that it needs and the revenue that it needs to be a successful public social media company.
And then one quick thing before I let you go. Does anybody really think that Jack Dorsey has the time for this?
Well, that's a good question. But Jack Dorsey, you know, I mean, Twitter is his baby, too. Right. And he, I think, will be engaged in the process. And yeah. I think it'll probably restore some confidence to investors. And that's really important right now when the company just hasn't done well over and over and people are worried.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thank you, Molly.
Twitter stock, by the way, jumped on the news. Meanwhile, mixed signals from economic reports. New numbers today show American retail sales up 1.2%. That's a huge improvement from the previous month, where spending barely budged. That was coupled with a good jobs report. It all sounds positive. And yet, not everyone convinced that the latest good news is all good news. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York.
My assignment today, become the enemy of joy by peering beyond some recent hopeful economic indicators. Wipe the smiles off the faces of those who are cheering recent positive news about spending and jobs. Our multi-pronged assault on macroeconomic merriment begins with former Fed economist Ann Owen.
You have to not pay too much attention to ups and downs that happen monthly.
Taking a wider view can paint a different picture. She's not satisfied with the job market.
There's still room for improvement.
A big problem is the kind of jobs Americans are able to get right now. Economist Carrie Leahy with Decision Economics worries their paychecks are too low.
While we are creating jobs, are we creating enough good jobs that will give you a decent middle-class standard of living? And there's a lot of concern about that.
Weaker paydays, of course, mean less money flowing through the economy. None of this is to say Owen, Leahy, or their colleagues are forecasting doom. They just think it's too early to throw a party. Now, plenty of economists are willing to at least contemplate ordering a sheet cake.
There are some little signs that we look to that say, like, you know, maybe it's not as grim as people fear.
Beth Ann Bovino is U.S. Chief Economist for Standard & Poor's and is willing to let a little joy into the picture, mainly because key data she watches have her predicting wages will rise.
That means more money in people's pocketbooks, and that means more money to spend. So I expect this to continue.
So whether you want to be cautiously optimistic or just plain optimistic, don't let just one report sway you too far. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Well, I was hoping to get through the week without using the G word, but it seems that world events have other ideas. So, Greece it is. This morning, after 4 months of intense talks, the International Monetary Fund, which is trying to negotiate with Greece for a solution to that country's debt crisis, up and walked away from the table. In a long string of stories about Greece, this one sounded extra bad. To help me understand just how bad, I've asked Paddy Hirsch to join me. He's a contributing editor here at Marketplace. Paddy, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure, Molly. Thanks for having me.
So last night, things sounded pretty good in terms of these negotiations. But now today, I'm reading words like exasperation, major differences, and even worse, no progress. What happened?
So basically, the IMF said it felt that the Greeks weren't making the kind of reforms that they need to on things like labor market and pension reforms. And they need to make those reforms if they're going to get more bailout money and pay down their debts. And, you know, there's been a lot of kind of window dressing by the Greek government. They've been saying, oh, things have been going fine. But the fact is that this impasse between Greece and its creditors still exists and hasn't really been taken down in any way. And today, Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, more or less accused the Greeks of playing games.
There's no more space for gambling. There's no more time for gambling. The day's coming, I am afraid, that someone says that the game is over, in fact.
So the talk is getting tougher. Is gambling the right word for what Greece has been doing?
I think it is. The Greeks gambled when they elected this hardline anti-austerity government, right? That really, really pushed back hard against its creditors. That had the apparent aim of giving them more room for negotiation and therefore maybe getting better terms on their bailout. But that just hasn't worked. As I said, they got some concessions, but nothing where they really wanted to be on taxes, on financing, and particularly on pensions, which is where the IMF really wants to see big cuts. And, you know, the IMF reckons that pensions and wages account for around 80% of Greece's total budget.
And now the IMF has emerged as an important player, maybe more than some people have realized. How key is the IMF here?
Well, it's a lot more important than people might think. You know, it was brought in by the Europeans, not just for the money, which has been important, but also to be an independent arbiter. And as such, the IMF has pushed on both sides. It's pushed for people who are owed money by Greece to forgive some of that debt, which hasn't gone down too well in some cases. But they've also been amongst the most insistent that Greece does cut its pension liabilities, which the Greeks, of course, have called absurd.
There was a point where a Greek exit seemed absurd, too. But is it getting more likely?
I think it is. And not just because the Greeks say that they've squeezed the blood out of every stone that they've got in the country and that they can't grow under these conditions, but also because, you know, creditors have kind of baked this calculation in now. You know, many have written off their Greek debt. They assume it's not going to get paid back. The international finance community is kind of braced for shockwaves. The problem is that those shockwaves may play out in unanticipated ways.
It seems like this is an ominous moment, but how serious is it? Is this game over, Greece, like Donald Tusk said?
I do not think it's completely over. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has said repeatedly that her aim is to keep Greece in the euro. And she said that again yesterday. And although the IMF negotiation team was recalled to DC, Christine Lagarde, who's head of the IMF, is going to be in Europe next week. Meanwhile, the Europeans are going to keep talking. I mean, European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker had something very amusing to say. We've got a translation of what he said here.
People are slowly getting impatient. I'm human too, so I share their impatience. You have to get the cow off the ice where it keeps on slipping. We're trying to push it off again today.
Illuminative, right?
Absolutely. That is colorful Greek tragedy in action. The tragedy goes on. Paddy Hirsch is the host of our online video explainer series, The Whiteboard, which you can find at marketplace.org. Thank you for breaking it down for us.
It's a pleasure, Molly. Thank you.
On Wall Street today, the good times roll on. We'll have more when we do the numbers. There's a lot of talk in the tech and business world about the next billion. That's the next billion people or more in the developing world who are expected to come online in the next few years. And they are a tempting target for companies who are looking at a potentially huge new customer base. And so tech companies are trying to figure out how to help them along. Google and Facebook are working on internet infrastructure plans. SpaceX just announced a plan to try to build a new satellite network to beam internet access around the globe. But not all these efforts to connect the developing world are being met with open arms.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you? Nice to see you.
I visited Facebook's headquarters in Menlo Park to talk to the guy responsible for Facebook's internet.org project. that company's plan to fulfill its internal mission.
Facebook's mission is to make the world more open and connected. And Internet.org's mission is to bring the 2/3 of the world online who have never been online before.
That's Chris Daniels. He's vice president of product for Internet.org, and he is a true believer.
If you look at the 2/3 of the world's population who isn't online today, about 1 billion people are out of reach of connectivity. About 1 billion people simply live at an income level where they can't afford connectivity. And then actually the biggest chunk, about 2 billion people, they could afford connectivity. They live within range of connectivity, but they aren't aware of why the internet would be valuable to their lives. So this application, the Internet.org application, provides people with exactly that, a set of free basic services that can provide immediate value to their lives so that they can start to understand why and how the internet is valuable to them. And then ultimately to have them become paying users of the internet and to join all of us online and, you know, getting the benefits of being online that we all receive. We want to make sure that everybody in the entire world has that.
But Internet.org generated a surprising amount of controversy, security, privacy, and concerns that it prioritizes some sites over others in violation of net neutrality principles. When you use Internet.org, you access some sites for free. The carrier pays the data charge. If you wanted to see more internet, you would have to pay. Now, that process of providing data access to some services for free is called zero rating. It's so controversial that some media companies in India pulled out of the project completely.
The primary thing that we saw in India was people who are advocating for the most pure form of net neutrality, where no zero rating would be permitted. And the question that I always come back to is whether that is a policy that would help to bring more people online and whether that's a policy that would actually be good for consumers. And that should be the ultimate question. And we don't think it's a policy that would benefit consumers or help bring more people online. Our belief here is that the principles of net neutrality must coexist with programs that bring people online. If the strongest form of net neutrality were to prevail and there's no zero rating and therefore no programs like this that can bring people online, you would be left with the majority of the world remaining offline. I think you'd be leaving people behind.
You really believe there's no other way, that there would be no other spread of access or information about internet access or interest in internet access were it not for a program like this?
I don't think there's no other way. There are certainly other ways that things can happen, but I do know that our program is working and bringing a significant number of new people online and more than any other program that I've seen.
And to be fair, in the 11 countries where Internet.org has rolled out, like Colombia, Guatemala, Zambia, India, and Bangladesh, 9 million people have come online, and 20% of those users had never accessed mobile data before. To Facebook, that's success.
And do you hope to eventually make money?
The goal of our group is to bring more people online. So that is where we're going to focus. If we wanted to focus on revenue, we'd probably invest the resources who are working on Internet.org somewhere else, like in our developed market advertising systems.
Despite the criticisms, Facebook says Internet.org is a good thing and is full steam ahead.
If it wasn't impactful, there wouldn't be skeptics.
Well said, right. Chris. Well said.
See you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Coming up.
I don't want to see a high rise if I'm hiking up back in those trails.
Why a proposal for affordable housing in Marin County is causing some drama. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 38 points, 0.2% to end at 18,039. The NASDAQ inched up 5 points, 0.1% to close at 5082. The S&P 500 ticked up 3 points, 0.1% to finish at 2108. Twitter had been trading flat during today's session, but jumped 7% when the CEO news broke. Speaking of people leaving, Rupert Murdoch, according to sources, may soon step down from the top spot at 21st Century Fox and hand the reins to his son, James. Fox fell 0.1% on that news, and News Corp slid 0.4%. News of good auto sales in May didn't do much for General Motors. The company fell 0.1% today. Tesla Motors, though, rose 0.25%. Krispy Kreme bit off a 13% gain after it raised its 2016 profit forecast. And Dunkin' Brands bobbed up 0.25%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.38%. And you're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported service. So to keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Donate at marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for May. The University of Michigan issues its preliminary June Consumer Sentiment Survey. And it had an epic running time and an epic budget. The Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton star, Cleopatra, premiered in New York on June 12, 1963. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. This week, we're spending some time looking at the issue of affordable housing through the story of one place where housing is exactly the opposite. That's Marin County, just north of San Francisco, where Marin resident George Lucas, yep, that one, says he'll use $100 million of his own dollars to build a couple hundred low-income apartments on a piece of land he owns called Grady Ranch. His spokesperson said that Lucas wants to do something nice for seniors and workers of Marin. Yesterday, we heard from folks who say this kind of project is exactly what Marin needs. But the not-in-my-backyard force is strong in Marin County. Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk has more.
As soon as word spread that I was doing a story about Grady Ranch, before I'd even finished calling people to set up my first interviews, people started calling me.
Hi, Chrissy. I understand that you may be up here in our area working on a story or so about Grady Ranch. I would like to offer myself as one that can provide input.
One woman tracked me down because she'd heard that I was going to interview someone she didn't see eye to eye with.
And I went, oh my God, I can't let that go uncountered.
And once I actually flew up to Marin and started doing the interviews...
Do you mind if I...
What is that? Sometimes the people I was recording wanted to record me, too.
This is a recorder.
Oh, you're recording. Let's just say this issue is fraught. Here are the basic details of the plan that's driving all the fraughtness. George Lucas wants to build 224 units of housing on a big old dairy ranch he bought years ago. Some of the housing will be for low-income seniors. Some will be so-called workforce housing, aimed at people whose households make between about $65,000 and $100,000 a year. I know those might sound like solid wages in most parts of the country, but in Marin's crazy expensive housing market, they can still leave you floundering.
My name is Marianne Rodriguez. I work for the County of Marin in the Aging and Adult Services Department.
I visited Rodriguez at the small apartment she lives in a crowded industrial part of Marin County. She says even this place is a struggle to afford.
There's a lot of apartment buildings, sometimes two or three families to a unit. The rest is usually auto repair shops.
The day the details of George Lucas's affordable housing plan came out, the developer he's working with got dozens of calls from people, including Rodriguez, asking to be put on the waiting list for the housing once it was built.
I read it in the paper and I said, wow. And I did get a hold of them. They took my name and number and said, we'll send you an update. It's wonderful. I think that's a great thing for Lucas to have taken on.
Meanwhile, in other parts of Marin, people were reacting to the news of George Lucas's plan very differently.
Made my heart sink and my stomach feel bad.
This is Maggie McCann, who lives a couple miles from the proposed project in a quiet, well-manicured subdivision. McCann is president of the Lucas Valley Homeowners Association. Lucas Valley, by the way, got its name way before George Lucas had anything to do with it. McCann invited me to her home to hear some of her neighborhood's concerns over the housing proposal.
Maggie, thank you.
I was expecting one or two people to be there.
Hello. Wow, you've got quite a group of people.
Chrissy, I'm Bruce Carmadale.
Instead, I found a room full of homeowners seated around a coffee table with stacks of reports and maps
nice
of the area.
Nice to meet you.
Hi. I'm Tom.
I'm Joy.
And
Liz.
Thank you all for coming.
Yeah. I didn't realize you'd be so nice. I know you were getting such a big crowd.
Yes. McCann and her neighbors first wanted to make one thing very clear.
No, we are not against affordable housing. We just want to see it done in a sensible, responsible, good way.
For example, how many more kids will it bring to their schools? What kind of impact on fire and police and other community services could the new housing have? For McCann's neighbor, Liz Dale, it's all about the details.
It may have traffic. It might look ugly. Stand out as a sore thumb, so to speak.
Dale and some others took me out to the property where the housing is being proposed.
Oh, I think it's beautiful. I used to ride my horse on this ranch when I was growing up, and it had cows on.
All you see is birds and trees and hills.
Tom Taylor, another neighbor, pulled out site plans for the project that he'd downloaded off the county website. In the drawings, some of the buildings are shown to go up to 4 stories high, 6 if you count the underground garages. The developer has said they'll be hidden from the road, but Taylor pointed to the ridgetop behind the site.
There's trails back there that most of the people in this valley really cherish. I don't want to see a high-rise if I'm hiking up back in those trails.
Before I left this group of homeowners, they had one more thing they wanted to say. Bruce Carmondale spoke up for the group.
And the last thing, and yes, this might sound really aggressive, is that, you know, there's a relationship. I mean, you guys are produced by USC.
By you guys, he meant this radio show, Marketplace. What concerned Carmondale was that George Lucas, the one who's funding this housing project, has donated a lot of money to USC. It's his alma mater.
So if it is truly a USC property that produces this, and he's a big donor, I would hope that that's disclosed.
Yeah, no.
So, for the record, Marketplace was produced by USC until about 15 years ago. They retained a production credit as part of the sale to our current parent company, APM. Marketplace has no editorial or financial relationship with USC. But the fact that Carmondale and his neighbors took the time to scrutinize all this is just one more example of how intense things have gotten over George Lucas's affordable housing plan around here. And this intensity has a backstory. 3 years ago, when George Lucas first announced his plan to build low-income housing on Grady Ranch, the news came in the middle of a larger discussion going on in Marin about whether there was enough affordable housing in the county at all, and how much more should be built.
I also have a number of handouts in the back, and I brought at least 100. But
this is tape from a community meeting that happened around that time. A bunch of the proposed sites for potentially building more affordable housing were in Lucas Valley, and some residents there felt they were getting more than their fair share of it compared to other wealthier parts of the county. Protest signs started popping up around the neighborhood. Committees were formed. Eventually, the local county supervisor set up this meeting as a sort of town hall.
There are some ground rules for tonight. Show respect to all who participate. No shouting or booing.
Those ground rules did not last long.
For those, please do not interrupt.
A few people expressed support for building more affordable housing.
I've seen plans over the years of very beautiful, environmentally friendly developments, and I think we could possibly have some terrific new neighbors, including my kids, who might be able to afford to live here as young adults.
But the most vocal people were not on board with the affordable housing proposals.
Basically, it looks like you volunteered
us
for the ghetto, basically.
Another woman pointed at her son sitting in the audience.
That's my kid. If you can't afford to live here in the future, tough luck.
Since that meeting, folks in favor of bringing more affordable housing to Lucas Valley and the rest of Marin have gotten more vocal themselves. Bruce Anderson raised his children and now his grandchildren in the neighborhood. He says he'd like to see more economic diversity here, that the quality of life that drew him to this area shouldn't just be available to high-income families.
It can be shared with another 200-300 people in our 5,000-person valley here. We have one of the best school systems here in Marin. They're doing a tremendous job for my grandson. I would like that to be available to many more people.
But while some welcome construction of more affordable housing in the area, there are still lots of residents who share underlying doubts that it will ruin the low-density suburban feel of the place, that because some of the housing will be exempt from property taxes, it'll put too much strain on local infrastructure. And then there's this deeper question that comes up. Does every place need to be affordable for everyone?
You know, some areas are going to be more expensive than others.
Justin Kai is a stay-at-home dad and sometimes real estate agent. He lives with his wife and infant son in a subdivision in Lucas Valley. His family moved to Marin 4 years ago, and it was a financial stretch for them, he says. But they wanted the big backyard, the access to good quality schools. He says he knows that many people can't afford to be in a place like this, And while he says he doesn't want to sound selfish,
I made great sacrifices to be here. I think it's selfish to expect that someone else should be able to acquire what we take part of for little or next to nothing.
Public hearings on the Grady Ranch development are expected to begin sometime next year. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, pity the poor, tired celebrity in yoga pants and Uggs, looking like a hot mess after a long flight, fighting the paparazzi on the way to the limo. Actually, that does sound terrible. Well, at LAX Airport here in Los Angeles, Delta is throwing those celebrities a bone thanks to its newly renovated terminal. For just $350 extra, over and above the cost of a first-class ticket, a Porsche will meet arriving celebrities on the tarmac, drive them through a secret tunnel, and take them to meet their own drivers out on the street. Departing travelers can use their own VIP entrance and secret corridor, and even get an escort to a private lounge. So I wonder, do you think you need some sort of famous person ID card to do this? Or will good old money suffice? Somebody try it and let me know. And that is Marketplace for the day. Today, the Dow rose 38 points, or 0.2%. The NASDAQ crept up just 5 points. And the S&P 500 was up 2 points, about 0.1%. Golda Arthur, Kate Kincannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Patty Hirsch are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. And I am Molly Wood. We'll be back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.